Welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. A show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs and CFRC, so a big thank you to both of them. If you miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. It's a great way to stay informed about all of the exciting research our graduate students and postdocs are working on. And today, I'd like to introduce you to Chris Greencorn, who's doing a PhD in history under the supervision of Dr. Lisa Pozzoli. Welcome to Grad Chat, Chris.
Thanks for having me on the show.
I am also in history, so I'm very excited to talk today about your project. But before we dive into your research, can you tell us a little bit about your journey to this point and what attracted you to Queen's?
Sure. Yeah. It's been sort of circular. I've come in and out of grad school a couple of times. I did my undergrad in Nova Scotia at St. Francis Xavier University, St. of X, in the history department. But I started there in the music faculty. There's a jazz studies program at St. of X. I didn't do especially well. I dropped out into general arts, but it ended up being my minor, essentially. I actually intended to come to Queen's for my master's, and that would have been in 2016. And for various reasons, I didn't. I chose to go to the University of Toronto and did a master's in the music faculty there in ethnomusicology, which is like the cultural studies, cultural anthropology of music. I took some time off in the middle. I came back. I got caught up in COVID. Mm. So it took some extra time to complete. And then afterwards, and then finally, when I decided I was ready to do a PhD, this would have been in 2021, coming up to the 2022 year. One of the main things that I considered was that in the time since I had considered Queen's before, one of the professors from the history department, whom I knew from my time there, she, this is Lisa Pozzoli, had joined the faculty here. So I reached out to Lisa, and she was super excited about it, as was I, and that pretty much sealed the deal. Yeah, so there's been a lot of in and out, but I am here and happy to be here.
Oh, no, that's great. And I will say for everyone listening, I am quite biased as Lisa Pozzoli was on my committee, and I think she is wonderful as well. So,
yeah.
Well, I'm glad that you and Lisa were able to reconnect and that you've been here since. So your research is titled Race and Authenticity in Helen Creighton's Collection of Nova Scotian Folk Culture. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that means?
Right. So to begin with, I suppose Helen Creighton was a folklorist, among other things, in Nova Scotia. She was born in 1899 and lived till 1989, so quite a long life. And even today, really, is the authority on Nova Scotian folk culture. Mm. She spent more than 40 years basically crisscrossing Nova Scotia and into New Brunswick and PEI, down the highways and byways in little villages, collecting folk songs, folk tales, superstitions, dances sometimes, like folk dances, and publishing that material, essentially. She started out as a journalist, more or less, on the radio, actually, in Halifax. Yeah, there's a brand new radio station there, like a CBC or CRBC affiliate at the time, in about 1926, 27. And she was looking for material, basically, like kind of local color, local interest material, which then led into this lifelong career in basically defining what folk music and other folk culture was in Nova Scotia. And so she was part of a broader movement towards that sort of thing that began maybe, 70 years earlier. There was a school of folklorists, originally English scholars, but then more formally folklorists at Harvard and some in the UK as well. And she sort of sat between them in terms of her approach. And so, yes, so Helen Creighton is sort of the buck stops with her in terms of what folk culture is. I come to it as someone who grew up in the middle of a folk music festival, which is a funny place to grow up in the middle of, but my parents started a folk music festival when I was a kid in my hometown. And so, yeah, basically my whole life have been directly involved in these sorts of definitions, like, what is folk music? Who or what is appropriate on a folk music stage? Those sorts of like the boundaries of a genre, lots of unspoken or implicit sorts of, definitions, shibboleths, like taboos even, but they are very much there. So yeah, on one level, I come to it from sort of a practical, like engaged, public-facing position. But then also I come to it as a musician and someone who's studied music academically.
Mm-hmm.
This ethnomusicology degree I told you about a moment ago. Thinking about music in society, music mm-hmm. in culture, how do these definitions or taboos work? You know, mm-hmm. what is the work that they do in the world? What do they include? What do they exclude?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, as I was in the middle of my master's program, a new, well, archival recording project was released in part by the Helen Creighton Folklore Society, which
okay.
sort of preserves her legacy in the public sphere, alongside the Black Cultural Center of Nova Scotia,
mm.
which is a museum, essentially, but also the organization around that. They released an archival recording collection of songs that Helen Creighton recorded in African Nova Scotian communities,
mm.
of which there were many.
Mm.
The way that that material was introduced, talked about in the liner notes and
mm.
sort of the literature around it, it piqued my interest.
Mm-hmm.
There was essentially the explanation was Helen Creighton was very much a product of her time
mm.
and, you know, brought her own prejudices to this work. But nonetheless, aren't we all so much richer for her having done that work?
Mm.
Which didn't quite sit right with me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it didn't exactly answer what the prejudices were. It acknowledged that they were there, but didn't dig any deeper. And basically, I went to the archives to find out. I was living in Halifax at the time. Public archives, Nova Scotia Archives, was right down the street
mm.
on the Dalhousie campus. So yeah, I got to work digging through the files,
mm-hmm.
Helen Creighton's files, and that's led me.
To
led me here, yeah.
It sounds like Creighton's work, well, it spans decades, and it's
yes.
and it's been, it sounds like, quite well preserved by different organizations, the society,
yeah.
and maybe more than other folks
yes.
have been. And you mentioned a little bit about liner notes, but what are some of the other types of sources or methods that you are working with to examine
mm-hmm.
her kind of body of work and the communities, you know, which interact
yeah.
via her recordings
yeah.
or via Creighton's views
yeah.
On those?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right that in terms of, like, you know, historical sources, the quantity and quality even of what has been preserved of Helen Creighton's working and personal life is really unusual.
Mm.
It's not, even for someone who lived through much of the 20th century,
mm-hmm.
It's quite uncommon to have that amount of material to work with. And there are two reasons for that. One is that she kept practically everything,
mm-hmm.
and in part because she didn't have an institutional sort of affiliation. She did her work mostly on her own. She worked with the National Museum, what's today the Canadian Museum mm-hmm. of History, in Ottawa for a while, well, for 20 years, but, you know, didn't have a university affiliation
mm-hmm.
or didn't, you know, work in government as such. You know, she was a contractor, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So her own collection was her way of establishing and maintaining her own legitimacy, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So she kept everything, all the correspondence with the leading figures in the field and many smaller, you know, less consequential people, recordings, photographs, the textual manuscript document collections that we as historians tend to focus on.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, you know, that's split into her sort of research material, but also personal collections.
Mm.
There's a whole series of diaries as well,
mm.
Which mainly served her to document her collecting, but also sort of personal information
mm-hmm.
is mixed within, right? Like she went to have lunch with somebody here and then, you know, got her recording machine fixed at the local shop, picked it up, and then headed off into the field where she stayed that night. She got a haircut the next day. You know, like it is her personal life and her professional life are very much tied up together.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, of course they are. The personal is political,
mm-hmm.
but it's also like she was personally invested in this. So
mm-hmm.
the collection itself is really striking and unusual. And it's also because she is so important in the sort of public image of Nova Scotian culture, the archives in Halifax, this is kind of like a crown jewel of their
mm-hmm.
collection, right? They've got, not only is it practically all there, but they've invested a lot of money in making it accessible, right?
Mm-hmm.
So much of the collection is available online, including the recordings, the photographs.
Wow.
Some of the textual material is still not digitized, and I don't know that it ever will be.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, like, there are various reasons for that, but the collection itself sort of shapes what it is I'm doing because
mm-hmm.
it is so unusual and important.
It sounds very, very rich, and
yes.
and like there's so many potential avenues
yes.
for you to take this. But you
yeah.
mentioned that
yeah.
Creighton's recording of Black Nova Scotians'
yes.
folk culture and music.
Yeah.
initially piqued your interest. Yeah. So how do race and folk culture intersect? And it right. sounds like that's what drew you in initially. Yes. So how does that intersect in your work?
Yeah. So deeply, deeply interested in how those two ideas, you know, race as an ideology and folk, you know, expressed through mm-hmm. folk culture, folk music, folk art, as another sort of ideology, resemble one another essentially, but also intersect in a specific way mm-hmm. with these folk culture collectors. And one really doesn't need to look very hard to find ways that they do. Mm-hmm. It just even in the sorts of arguments that are put forward in their published collections or their letters back and forth to one another, the way that we might refer to culture or ethnicity mm. or these sorts of terms today in the 1920s or earlier even, in fact, up probably until the Second World War, mm. were expressed in terms of race. Mm. And yes, it's abundantly clear. There's no, this isn't really a radical argument. If you look at the sources, folk culture as well, also expressed in terms of race. And they both deal with the sort of essence of a group of people, right? Mm. Race, it's often expressed in terms of like race is biological mm. and ethnicity is more cultural or social. I'm not sure that I agree with that distinction, mm-hmm. but race is a concept which traffics in sort of essences of people, you know, mm. what is fundamentally basically true about a group of people, usually as defined by like a phenotypical, mm. their appearance, physical characteristics. But as well, like race in the period was used much the same way as we would use nation or nationality mm. as well. So all of these concepts, race, nationality, ethnicity, culture, they're deeply, deeply imbricated, you know, layered on top mm-hmm. of one another, intersecting. And folk culture, at least in the way that Helen Creighton and her sort of colleagues or contemporaries mm. used it, supported this kind of national identity. You know, mm. it also represents a sort of fundamental essence of a culture, more through culture in the sense that we would think of like art and music mm. and not a group of people in the sociological definition, but culture as high culture, as the arts. Mm-hmm. They are aligned in a very specific way. Now, where I'm interested specifically is the ways that racialized groups, minoritized racialized groups, are included or excluded mm. in this canon of what is Nova Scotian mm-hmm. For Creighton. So Nova Scotia is itself an interesting case study for several reasons. It was in the grand scope of Canadian, you know, pre-Confederation, quote-unquote Canadian colonial history, mm-hmm. quite a cosmopolitan place. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of people from a lot of different places coming in and out. Prior to the 1960s, it had the largest African-Canadian population, both in relative and absolute terms, mm-hmm. So as a percentage of the population, and also in just sort of blunt numbers. And it is also the case that essentially one Indigenous group, one First Nation, the Mi'kmaq. The Nova Scotia is within the traditional territory mm-hmm. of the Mi'kmaq. So in both cases, it's distinct from many of the other colonies and then later provinces mm-hmm, mm-hmm. in demographic terms, without even considering the various European settler groups who mixed and mingled in Nova Scotia as both colony and province. British in its various forms, so the nations which make up mm-hmm. the UK, but also a variety of other European groups, most distinctly Acadians, mm-hmm. Who were the descendants of some early French settlers, the Scottish Gaelic immigrants primarily to Cape Breton and the northeastern part of Nova Scotia, and then also some German mm-hmm. immigrants in the Lunenburg County area. So some really distinct groups, kind of a constellation of groups that Creighton, among others, was interested in establishing sort of a hierarchy mm. Of in terms of what was most representative of Nova Scotia mm-hmm. In historical perspective, but also in the present. My dissertation is exploring each of these groups, the settlers, the African Nova Scotians, and Mi'kmaq distinctly, because the way that folk and race are interconnected differs between them in sort of consequential ways. This shows up mostly in the context of authenticity, as you mentioned in the question. What was authentic expression, folkloric expression within one of these groups? Where authenticity comes into the equation amongst each of these groups. For the settlers, for example, the foreignness of the material, mm. the fact that it had come from somewhere else, Europe primarily, was what didn't act counter to their authenticity. In fact, it bolstered their authenticity in the opinion of Creighton and others like them. The Britishness in particular of what were called child ballads, like a canon of a few hundred traditional English and Scottish ballads. The fact that they had shown up in Nova Scotia was perfect, you know. That reiterated a kind of position about the Britishness of Nova Scotia. So their authenticity depended on a certain foreignness to the specific geographical context. This was inverted in several ways for Black African Nova Scotians and for the Mi'kmaq. Mm. So, you know, African Nova Scotians, by definition, had also come from somewhere else. Mm. There were both free and enslaved people of African descent in Nova Scotia from early on in the history of the colony. And by Creighton's time, a large population, I mean, small in sort of absolute terms, but large in the context of the Canadian colonies and provinces. So in Creighton's research in those communities, in African Nova Scotian communities, the fact she was looking for material that had been created, composed within a folkloric tradition, but within Nova Scotia specifically, not brought from somewhere else. So that's a critical difference between the settler groups, though both were not indigenous in the sense we would use the term today, capital I, indigenous, to Nova Scotia. They had both come from somewhere else. So that intrinsically disadvantaged that material sort of in this hierarchy of what was most representative, notwithstanding the fact that they had both come from somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And this was inverted yet again for the Mi'kmaq material. Mm. So in that case, Creighton collected both material that we would think of as sort of traditional material, like pre-contact sort of traditions, but also material that had been developed over the 300 and a bit year history at that point of Mi'kmaq Catholicism. Mm. So early on in the French colonial period, the Mi'kmaq aligned themselves with the Catholic Church, and in the time that had elapsed, it had become an important element of their culture. Of course, like there are some negative implications, but in terms of the expressions that these Mi'kmaq sources offered Creighton to record and archive, the Catholic material was really quite a significant portion of that. Mm. It was important to them, important for them to have preserved, but Creighton made an important distinction between these two different types of materials. She felt that one was more representative than the other, even though both were traditions of considerable historical length and importance. Mm-hmm. So the distinctions between these groups are clearly racialized, essentially. The fact that you can track this inversion of indigeneity and foreignness and authenticity as negotiated between those two poles across these clear racial lines is essentially what I'm exploring in my dissertation. It hasn't been explored yet, and I think that it pushes back at the tendency for people who are commemorating Creighton's work, which of course was important, to say, well, she was a product of her time, these prejudices were in a different place now. Some even go as far as to argue that she was a sort of like proto-multiculturalist. But the fact alone that she collected across these groups, which supports the argument that she was sort of a multiculturalist, ignores the fact that she didn't sort of look equally upon all of this material. Some was prioritized or the inverse according to various racialized ideas about what was authentically folkloric, what was folk culture in a Nova Scotian context. And it is no surprise, really, then, that the people who were racialized and minoritized in other contexts were also minoritized and racialized in this context as well. So in part cultural history of the collection, in part social history of discrimination within within a Nova Scotian context. Right, so race and ethnicity, really quite important to the collection. I'm trying to get to the bottom of it.
No, it sounds, and I mean, your explanation of how Creighton could understand one group, say white settlers with a British heritage, as and their folk cultures as a connection back to British imperial history, as a sign of, therefore, Nova Scotia, Nova Scotianness, and you know, an idealized version of white British culture being what Nova Scotian culture is, and then in contrast with African Nova Scotians, like you said, having the same history of movement, although, you know, different because of histories of enslavement, but yes. having same movement to a new place and new land mm-hmm. and then transporting music and adapting it to a new place, but yes. having that somehow discredit yes. their claim to being an authentic Nova Scotian.
Yeah,
and exactly. then again, like how you, yeah. how you elucidated very well, again, of course, Mi'kmaq being the original mm-hmm. inhabitants and caretakers of the land, having another kind of leap or change in logic to discredit their
yes.
adapted or interpretation of Catholicism,
yeah.
showing again that somehow they're not therefore mm-hmm. part of a Nova Scotian identity mm-hmm. or ideal in Creighton's mind. So
yes, absolutely.
Yeah, no, that makes, it makes a lot of sense. And it's very interesting how you're pulling on these different sources and reading them critically. And,
yes.
and again, like not discounting the importance of all of these recordings as a whole
yeah.
And the work of preserving folk culture,
mm-hmm.
but just looking with a critical eye and saying, okay, well, what does this tell us mm-hmm. about how different groups have been appreciated or,
right.
or
yeah.
Recognized over yes. time.
Yeah. An element of it is also taking seriously what Creighton did herself,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, to your point about not discounting the work,
mm-hmm.
Is in the tradition of feminist or women's history
mm-hmm.
to take seriously the work of these, what were often described by their male counterparts as women amateurs, basically.
Mm-hmm.
I'm taking the opposite position here and saying that what she did was very important. And in order to properly appreciate this, we need to think about it critically.
Mm-hmm.
And this is because it is so consequential, right?
Mm-hmm.
This work is essentially the definition of what folk culture is today in Nova Scotia, with all of its, you know, with these logics of racialized authenticity that
mm-hmm.
you still see playing out in a thousand different ways.
Mm-hmm.
Really, my critique is not to put Creighton down or to just say that she was a racist, because that's not a very interesting argument on
mm-hmm.
its own. It's to understand how that kind of thinking, how that ideology works,
mm-hmm.
basically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, I think that's, I think it's sometimes people can lose that nuance, right?
Mm-hmm.
That mm-hmm. critical inquiry or deep look at something, and
yeah.
showing the way these logics unfold and work
mm.
doesn't necessarily discredit other parts of,
no.
of work. I think
no.
I think sometimes that's a misconception about what critical scholarship can do and look like, but it's really
yeah.
trying to pull apart and tease out all of this nuance to
mm-hmm.
show what it can really tell us. And with that, what do you think studying folk music offers us today?
It's a good question. It has a bit of a reputation for being quaint and not very relevant. On the other hand, I think it offers us a way into discussing these, for example, the way that racialization
mm.
works, the way that race and ethnicity and culture and nation are all deeply, deeply tied up in one another, in a medium that essentially everybody has an opinion on, you know, like we all have some stake, have some skin in the game of music, you know,
mm-hmm.
like very few people will say, no, I don't listen to music. I don't like music.
mm-hmm.
It's not for me. Music as a sort of cultural expression is fairly widely accessible.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, like some folks might think that folk music is quaint. Others are very much invested in it. But on either side, it tells us a lot about how we view ourselves,
mm-hmm.
right? Because of this sort of essential characteristic of the folk, you know, who that core of a culture represents
mm-hmm.
or is represented in that. Yeah, it tells us a lot about who we think ourselves to be,
mm.
the sort of stories we tell ourselves about ourselves, to quote Clifford Geertz, the anthropologist. I think there are also like a variety of historical reasons why folk music has been an important part of propagandizing for various causes
mm-hmm.
on the left and on the right, and in our like current political climate, having a more critical view of what folk music is and means
mm-hmm.
is an important tool in our toolkit, I think. But maybe on the most practical level, and I'm kind of circling back to the answer to the previous question, I think that studying folk music in this specific Nova Scotian context offers us another way to break down these, what are still today fairly clear, racially segregated lines within the society, within culture. It's, like folk music alone won't do it, but it is an important part of how Nova Scotians conceptualize themselves.
Mm.
So understanding the ways that is a fundamentally racialized concept and then potentially working against it
mm-hmm.
is is kind of the activist bent in this kind of scholarship.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And it sounds like you're seeing your work, what it can do. So where do you see your work developing into the future?
Primarily, there were many other, especially women collectors like Creighton, that did similar work across the country around the same time.
Mm.
So initially, this project was conceived of as a cohort study of a handful of these women.
Wow, that would be a lot.
Yeah, yeah. So as comprehensive and extensive as the Creighton collection is, tackling five of those, four or yes. five of those would have been, well, it was a bit insane. So the current project is scaled down a bit. But in terms of future research, yes, I would like to explore how these other, again, primarily women collectors developed similar ideas on similar material in different parts of the country, mm-hmm. how they worked together, communicated with each other. And ultimately, like, one of the most important and most influential folklorists of the 20th century in Canada was one of these women folklorists. She grew up in the Gaspé in Quebec, mm-hmm. but became the chief of the folklore section, later division, and finally the Canadian Center for Folk Culture Studies at the National Museum,
wow.
a federal research laboratory for folklore in the 1970s, mm-hmm. that ahead of the Royal Commission on Bilingualism and mm-hmm. Biculturalism, which defined official multiculturalism as we know it, shifted the direction of folklore research within Canada to align with this sort of new configuration of ethnic and racial politics in Canada, like alongside, but even slightly before, the sort of official discourse.
Mm-hmm.
Her name was Carmen Hua. So like tracking that process at a federal institution is one of the projects I've got in the can.
Mm.
Like, I'd like to think more about how Scottish collectors coming through Nova Scotia, mm-hmm. New Scotland, helped to define, or, you know, what the relationship was mm-hmm. between Nova Scotian regionalism and Scottish cultural nationalism, which was also taking shape at the time, you know, pre-devolution. Yeah, so there's so much more work to be done in this field. There are some well-known, well-regarded studies already, but many, many more to be done. And I think in part that comes from the fact that folklorists, anthropologists, ethnomusicologists tend not to be historical in their methodological approach, right?
Mm.
They're working in the field, interviewing people, doing oral history, but the sort of deep historical archival research is less the expectation, for example, for grad students.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, many more historical studies waiting to be done in this area. I'm hoping to tackle a, you know, slice yes. off a little bit of that, but really, really lots and lots of work to be done. Yeah.
Oh, that sounds very exciting, and I'm hoping you'll be able to continue this research as you finish up your PhD, but also moving forward into mm-hmm. the future. So Chris, it has been great chatting with you. Thank you for doing the show, and best of luck with the rest of the PhD and then all of these other projects that are on the horizon.
Well, thank you very much.
So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download this show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. Just search Grad Chat. Until next week, this is KM on the FM.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University, situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of the Faculty of Engineering and Applied Science.